Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. Force, Upsetting Rape Culture, is an activist collaboration based in Baltimore that believes we need to have a more difficult and honest conversation about sexual violence in America. Two of the people leading that conversation are Saida Agostini, Force's Chief Operating Officer, and Shanti Flagg, Studio Director. One of the ways Force upsets the culture of rape is with the Monument Quilt, a public art project that collects stories of survivors and their supporters, stitched together on red fabric. Force is also known for pulling pranks on Playboy and Victoria's Secret to promote a culture of consent. Just a warning, in this episode we discuss sexual and domestic violence, and there's some explicit language. Here's our conversation. How did you both get involved with Force?
So I actually came to Force about 2 years ago. I was originally at Free State Justice, which is an LGBTQ statewide advocacy organization. And I would meet Hannah at different advocacy things. And Hannah was always like, hey, don't you want to do this? Don't you want to do that? And I never kind of thought about becoming involved in survivor work. And it was really interesting because I thought about all of the different ways in which, like, I identified really openly and proudly, right? Like, so I really identified very openly as a Black woman. I really identified very openly as being the daughter of immigrants and very much as queer. And, you know, I will go around every day and tell everyone that Rihanna is half Guyanese. My family's Guyanese, and I love that Rihanna's half Guyanese. That's a tangent. But anyway.
Well, I go around and tell people that Rihanna is a Pisces, like me, big Rihanna fan. So I understand, like, you have to get the Rihanna facts out there.
It's important. People need to know. People don't know that Rihanna is half Guyanese.
Rihanna education really should be more at the forefront in this country. Just getting that out there.
Yes, yes, yes. Rihanna is half Guyanese, for those people who don't know. But I started to recognize that there are a lot of ways in which I did not talk about my identity as a survivor. And starting to do work through Force really resonated with me that I wasn't talking about that at all, like either in my art or in my advocacy work. And when an opportunity came up to actually work with Force as Chief Operating Officer, I kind of jumped at it. It kind of felt like a really good fit in terms of being able to actually work with artists, continue doing advocacy work, and it's been a really good ride.
How about you, Shanti?
Yeah, I started at Force about 3 years ago. That was when I graduated from college. So working at Force was my first position out of college. I studied art, so I was seeking a position in my field. And I had already, like, done work and, like, had an interest in, you know, the, like, advocacy for survivors. You know, when I was, like, younger, I did, like, volunteer work. And, like, when I was in college, I did, you know, I was in, like, student groups, that kind of thing. So I just saw a job posting online, and I moved to Baltimore for the position. It started out as like a very part-time position when I studio manager for, you know, and that was 3 years ago. And since then, the Force studio has moved to Motorhouse, where we're located today. My position has expanded, and in general, like Force's, like that they do has expanded.
Saida, tell me about the process of starting to identify as a survivor, and was that challenging for you?
It was challenging. I mean, I guess it's interesting, right? I think especially as a poet, you know, I come from a world where everything is kind of out on the table. You know, like you're supposed to write from a place of complete and absolute honesty all of the time. Like you're just supposed to put it out there. One of my poetry mentors, Toy Derricotte, you know, I remember on my first day of poetry workshop, she put up this quote on the wall, and the quote said, "Writing is easy. You just have to cut open a vein and start." And I was like, well, damn.
Sounds so easy.
I was like, all right, okay, that sounds painful. And, you know, I think for a little while, especially when I was younger, I was writing a lot about my trauma, especially around surviving. But I started to kind of locate within that, that the hard part for me about being a survivor wasn't necessarily the experience itself, but the reactions of people around me, right? And I think that's when we start to kind of talk about, like, what does rape culture actually mean? Because what was really painful for me was the fact that people didn't necessarily believe me. And what did it mean to kind of be in my own body and know what I had experienced? And not understand or like not know how to tend to me or not really have any tenderness about me or just tell me that I should just get over it. And there's tons of statistics that we could talk about that back all this stuff up, right? But the reality is that I kind of got to a point, especially when I started working with Force, that I was like, you know what? You know, like, fuck it. Now I'm 35. I'm still processing what that means to me. I'm 35 years old. Fuck it. Like, I'm in a place where I have the right to be believed, you know? And I think especially as a Black queer woman, there's so many spaces in which we're not believed that I'm tired of being in a place where I know my narrative. I know what I've gone through. And I don't want to dance around to other people's emotions and feelings about my own narrative. And so I think that being at Force has forced me to very much demand my own space for it.
For those who don't know, what is rape culture?
So I guess for me, rape culture is just a culture that normalizes sexual violence, that says that like sexual violence is a natural part of being alive, that like in one way or another, we're all going to have to encounter that issue. You know, either you'll be a survivor, you'll know someone who's a survivor, you'll be a perpetrator, you'll know someone who's a perpetrator, and it's inevitable. So I think that that is like the one of the most important parts of understanding rape culture for me is just like the idea that like this is just the way things are. It's natural for sex and relationships to be violent, particularly against women, and that is not going to change. So yeah, I think Force comes back against those ideas of rape culture by saying like, well, what if we actually like take a look at the stuff that we're saying is normal, which is not taking care with other people, not treating other people like they're, you know, have emotions and, you know, like they matter, you know, and like everybody deserves to have autonomy over their own body. Mm. Rape culture says we don't deserve that. And it's naive to think that that is something that people could achieve.
I know that Force emphasizes survivor-led advocacy. I was wondering if you could tell me about the importance of that.
Yeah, I think that's really huge. And also just to kind of like, if I want to build on what you were saying too, because I think that like the last piece particularly always resonates with me. So this idea, right? Like I think like when we distill it down, when we talk about rape culture, it's like this, the other piece is that it's essentially telling us that we don't have the right to control what happens to our own body, right? And so then also, it also helps us understand why rape culture is connected to white supremacy, and how rape culture is connected to transphobia and homophobia, because rape culture is essentially this understanding that, you know, other people then have the right to racially profile you. Other people have the right to essentially use you, and you have no recourse. Right. So I know especially, you know, we were witnessing the riots in Charlottesville. And I think that's something that for a lot of us in the office, like that impacted us greatly. I'm talking about us like we're like 25 people. Well, with the leadership team, we are. But it impacted us a great deal. Right. Because the folks who really were criminalized around that were the ones who were pulling down the Confederate statues. Right. And it kind of spoke to once again, like when you resist, the ones who are punished are the people who are resisting. Right. So I think that's really huge. And I think that's also why having survivor-led advocacy is so important, because the communities that are being the most impacted by rape culture, by racism, by homophobia, by all these different oppressions are the ones who are the best capable about speaking about what is happening to them. So the field that I've been trained in is social work. And oftentimes in social work, what you'll see is the people who are creating the policies and the programs are not the ones who are actually in that community. One of the most beautiful things I witnessed recently in Baltimore is the ceasefire. And I think what has made that so powerful is because the ceasefire was actually created by folks who were directly impacted by it, by folks who are from the community. And I think that what is so also so frustrating is that people are like, wow, look, that's really amazing. And I'm like, no, actually, it's beautiful that that was created and the energy behind it. But what's frustrating is that you seem to think that the community is just now coming up with these ideas. We've always had these ideas. We've always been doing these interventions. The fact now that white folks and people from outside of the community are just now starting to look at that is a problem.
I wonder, too, like you said, a lot of times the people making policies are not necessarily of the community or it's not survivor-led. Do you feel that also people's experiences are kind of like lumped together or whitewashed? I just kind of think of how, you know, there are a myriad female experiences. There's not one female experience. There are a myriad of gay experiences. And I wonder if people incorrectly think that all survivors of sexual violence have gone through similar things when that might not be the case.
Yeah, I definitely think that is true. I mean, I think when people think about this issue, they want to imagine it in a way that's comfortable for them and that doesn't address the aspects of our culture and therefore every person's individual participation in like creating a problem like this. So it's easier to say it happens to a particular person in a particular way because that compartmentalizes it away from yourself and the people you care about.
Tell me about the monument quilt and where the idea came from.
So the monument quilt, and Shanti, jump in if I like get something wrong. So the monument quilt was conceptualized by the founders, Hannah Brancato and Rebecca Nagel. And I think the initial idea was that it was going to be a picnic on the National Mall where people would get together and talk about rape culture and how to end it. And that was the initial Kickstarter. And the initial Kickstarter raised way more than money than they anticipated. And the idea took off. People were like, wow, this idea of kind of quilting together people's stories and painting and stitching it and drawing it onto red fabric is this like beautiful, powerful thing. And we want to be a part of it, right? And I think it also speaks to kind of just what you talked about, this idea that like sexual assault and domestic violence is not monolithic, right? I think, and also the quilt is a part of pushing back against that, just because no one story can represent in any way any abuse. You know, we all have such different narratives. And so it kind of just took off from there. We ended up creating a leadership team in 2015. And it's actually now an incredibly powerful international group of folks. We actually have a sister project in Mexico that is through La Casa Mandarina. I don't know. Do you have a good Spanish accent? Because I can't say it.
La Casa Mandarina?
Okay, great. Yes. And so they have our sister project where they basically do the monument quilt as well there. And through the labor of this incredibly dope leadership team where we have people from all over the country and Mexico, we have been working on the monument quilt and doing projects and displays all over the country. And now we have 2,200 quilt squares, 2,200 stories that we have done displays around, let's see.
Yeah, and just, you know, maybe for people who like haven't heard of the project, so it's a collection of quilted stories from survivors of sexual violence and their allies. So survivors can write stories about their own experiences or messages of support to other survivors, and then we ask allies or supporters to just write messages of support to survivors. So, sorry, what was your question earlier? Oh, yeah, displays. Yeah. So in, I guess, April of 2016... that was when we did Not Alone Baltimore, or was
yes.
it?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Not Alone Baltimore. So that was when we blanketed North Avenue, like a quarter mile of North Avenue around the Monument Quilt Studio, which is at Motor House. So that's North Avenue and Howard Street down to the Why Not lot. Actually, no, a little further, I think. Yeah. Quarter mile of North Avenue, whatever that was. I think that the monument quilt, we like always like forget the exact numbers, but the quilt has been displayed like between 40 and 50 times, and I think even more because there's times when just portions of it have been displayed that we, you know, in our heads just like forget about. And it's been in over like, I would say 30 to 40 cities around the country. And then the sister project that Saida was talking about in Mexico has been displayed as well, like in different countries in South America and Central America.
So this is going to culminate in a large quilt over the National Mall next year. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you two go on the West Coast tour of the quilt?
Shanti did.
Shanti did.
I went to one stop. I went to the border display at El Paso and Juarez.
What was your experience like there?
I mean, it was amazing. So they had been planning, that display had been something that we had been talking about for like years. Like when I started working on the project, I think the idea was already there and it was already like a little bit old, like, you know, so it was really, and, you know, when I heard about that was going to happen, I was like, I really want to be there for that. Because, like, my position is, like, not really about, like, going out to quilt displays as much as, or at least in the past anyway, as it had been about, like, keeping the studio open while other people have to go on tour. So I was like, yeah, that's my job, but I really want to be there for this display. So to be able to go and to, like, see that, like, actually happen after we'd been planning it for so long, and not even just us, I think most of the planning was done by people on the other side. So our, like, partners, Juan and Mora and Ava and Max and Lorena and other people who were down there. So yeah, it was amazing. So we did both sides. So I didn't know this before I went to El Paso, but, like, El Paso and Juarez are, like, the same city with a fence running through it. I didn't really understand that until I saw it, because I feel like people just think, like, oh, like, yeah, there's a fence, maybe, I don't know if there's a fence or not, and also, like, stuff like that doesn't happen in America. Like, fences between cities are something that happen, like, it, cutting through a city is something that happens other places. So it was really powerful to see that and to just see how messed up that was, and just, yeah, to, like, understand, you know, how, you know, a border is an idea, you know, and mm-hmm. it doesn't actually change the people who are present. It doesn't, like, the culture that's present in El Paso is not different from the culture that's present in Juarez. And what, you know, that was what I understood, is, like, this artificial attempt to, like, break people from each other. It's not, it doesn't seem natural when you're there, and it's not. So yeah, we did a display in El Paso and then across the border in Juarez, where we spelled out Not Alone in English and in Spanish. So it was really powerful.
And it was like on Trump's 100th right. day in office, right? Mm-hmm. Like protesting his xenophobic immigration policies and its impact that it's had on immigrants. And yeah, it was just, you know, I think like that's, like, I think probably one of my favorite things about working with Force, about the way in which, like, we connect rape culture to the different issues that are happening right now, and how that resonates, I think, so much. We were even talking about that this morning, and, like, always talk and about how we're always trying to figure out, like, well, what is it that connects so much with us, and how is it connects with our heart? And so even knowing, like, how much Trump's immigration policies, especially in light of his revocation of DACA right now, is going to impact undocumented young people, thinking back to this display is really powerful. Especially, so that border display particularly was meant to highlight how xenophobic immigration policies really marginalize undocumented populations that are already vulnerable to sexual assault. So, yeah, I mean, even just hearing about it just kind of gives me shivers right now.
What kind of reactions do you get from the monument quilt?
It's a range. I mean, I will say, like, I think I started to kind of really get it when I did a display that we did at Towson, and I had somebody come up to me and just say, you know, it was an elder, and they said to me, you know, I didn't really realize I was a survivor until I came here. You know, and this was someone who, like, was maybe in their 60s or 70s.
And that happens, like, every display, you know, yeah. to multiple people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even the one, you know, because obviously not everybody who goes through that shares it with anyone. I mean, I think a lot of times when I think about, like, why I, like, want to do the work is I remember something that happened at the Not Alone Baltimore display, which was when we were, like, getting just to starting to pack up pretty soon. And this woman came up to me and she was like, I'm here, like, I need to find my quilt square. And I was like, oh, okay, like, I'm the person, you know, she did find me, even though I don't think she knew who to talk to, but I would be the person who, like, could help her do that. So I was like, okay, I gotta do it. And it was, you know, I was just really nervous about, like, not being able to find her piece before we had to start packing up, because that would have been really sad. But we did find it, even though it seemed like we really weren't going to. And that was just, like, the first time that she saw it displayed, you know, and it was clearly just, like, really, like, powerful for her to just see it like that. And, yeah, I don't think I'll ever forget that.
Why is it important for survivors of sexual and domestic violence to have their stories told, you know, in a public place and to have a monument of sorts?
I mean, I think it matters to me for, like, just on a personal level. It's, like, really healing. Like, I get emotional when I think about it. You know, so I'm a survivor of child sexual abuse. And I'm also a survivor of domestic violence. And I like to think about like how my life could have been different if the Monument Quilt had existed, you know, when if I was younger, or if it had existed and my parents had been there. You know, I'm trying to make sure I don't give away any qualifying information, so Shanti, just poke me if I do. But I remember being at an event, and I was just talking about the Monument Quilt, and I had a parent reach out to me afterwards and talk about their child being a survivor, and just talk to me about, you know, how hard it was, and like how they were trying to do the right thing, but they didn't know if they were doing the right thing, you know. And I just remember thinking about, like, because I came out and I talked about the work that we did, I became a space where she felt she could be brave enough to talk about it, you know? And we have so many taboos around sexual and domestic violence that it is almost never safe enough to talk about it. Like, never, you know? And I just thought about, like, the grief that she must be carrying. And I think, like, the Monument Quilt becomes a space, like, where people can kind of let it down for a few moments. And if for nothing else, like, that is why I'm here. That is, like, why for me, like, I want to continue to be here and do this work. Because it almost becomes healing for me and for my family, even if they don't know
it. This is obviously very emotional, heavy work that you both do. I mean, how do you take care of yourselves?
Well, we definitely make sure that everybody gets the vacation time they need.
Amen.
Honestly, the number one is to just know that, like, people need space from the work, you know, and, like, it's not necessarily going to be the same kind of structure of, like, other workplace environments because, like, you know, there might just be a day where you can't. You know, and then that's okay. And you know, you can still come in the next day or whatever it is because you just need that space. Yeah. I talk to people in my life, you know, about the work. And that can be hard sometimes too because I don't want to be someone who's like bringing like negativity or sadness from like my workplace to, you know, especially when it's someone I care about. But I'm lucky I have people who are supportive and who like, you know, who can hear it without taking it on.
I have art, which is really fortunate.
That too.
Yeah. But it's hard also because I will say, like, right now, Shanti, I don't know if you're finding this right now in your work, but I'm finding right now in my work, a lot of my art is, like, around my trauma. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're fine. Yeah, so that's kind of a clusterfuck. So there's that. And then also, like, I watch a lot of really, like, bro television. I'm not going to discuss what television shows I watch because I don't want to be judged.
By me or by other people?
By other people.
I think TV should be judgment-free. It's just entertainment, right? Who cares?
And I buy a lot of gowns. I love clothing.
I love shopping.
Yes.
Retail therapy works, huh?
Yeah. Yes. That's, yeah.
So since you both started working with Force, how have you seen the conversation around sexual violence and assault in this country change, if at all?
Well, I think honestly, like before I started working there, I started to see the effects of Force's work changing the conversation because, I guess, you know, I'm younger. So I think like especially a lot of Force's early work was more like targeted to like my age group or was like more popular with my age group because they did the Victoria's Secret like underwear prank where they pretended to be Victoria's Secret releasing a line of like consent themed underwear. I think that was in 2012 or maybe mm-hmm. earlier. I don't remember now. But I think at that point, it just like wasn't really a thing, like consent underwear or like generally like consent, like merchandise, like wasn't necessarily like a popular thing or whatever. And, you know, now obviously it's like a dime a dozen. So I think like people started, that was like using like advertising and like manipulating advertising was like a really smart way to get people to pay attention because they didn't volunteer to pay attention to it. It was something of a manipulation, but you know, not a harmful one because it got people to listen. So I think when I was younger, like I started to see the ways in which like Force and like other like organizations working against rape culture began to change the conversation to like you know, from, like, I mean, there's changes that have, like, happened and then changed again, I think. So, like, I feel like when I was a child, it was, like, no means no. When I, like, got older, there was, like, ways in which that phrase had been, like, manipulated by people who don't, like, support, you know, the, like, fight to end rape. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, there was, like, a lot
saying, like, she didn't say no explicitly in, like, a court situation or something.
Yeah. And then I think also, and then also, like, presenting sex or, like, presenting, women's choice of sex as, like, an absence of a no. And just, like, presenting it as, like, women aren't, I don't know, it's, I feel, you know, I think that I heard the critique when I was younger that it's just, like, presenting it as if, like, women, like, really never have sexual pleasure. It's just, like, about, like, the man directing it, and then, like, the women are either, like, okay with it or really not okay with it, not, like, that it would be, like, something that is a part of a natural part of a woman's life that she might direct, you know?
Or that the default is yes, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you don't speak up and say the
say no,
then it's then like it's yes, you're just walking around as a yes, which we know not to be the case.
So there was all that. Then that since changed to yes means yes. So I think that happened when, or like people started like using that phrase when I was like a teenager. And then since then, like me, other people my age, and then like other activists or whatever have certain like problems with that or whatever. So I think a lot of things that happen that are like changes like this are like you make a change that addresses one issue, other issues come up, and also the like language change that has been created becomes manipulated by the other side, so you have to do it again. So I think that that is kind of like a constant fight that force has like definitely been a part of, just like trying to like share like how can we talk about this in a way that is helpful.
I think I've witnessed a lot of changes, and I think I've also kind of like continued to see some ways in which we need to kind of pull apart how it is we understand rape culture, you know? Which is why, like, I'm really glad that we're doing this work, because I think actually art continues to be a really powerful way to continue to push our understanding and notions. You know, one thing that I kind of continue to always struggle against, you know, so I'm a survivor of, I'm a queer survivor of domestic violence. So, you know, my partner was a woman, and it really took my therapist being like, girl, you were in an abusive relationship, for me to kind of understand that I was in an abusive relationship, you know? And I think there's so much that continues to be hidden around, like, same gender relationships and domestic violence and rape, and like how it is we witness domestic and sexual violence in these relationships. And I think it's really crucial. And then also I think like just kind of understanding how it is we gender violence is really important. I mean, I think patriarchy is real, like that is something that I would never deny, but being able to kind of like navigate how it is we understand those concepts and how that informs rape culture, I think is really crucial. And then also, I think one thing that Forrest, I think, continues to do is like help people kind of to see how rape culture intersects with other forms of oppression. Like, how does rape culture, you know, play a role in like the Dakota Access Pipeline? Or how does rape culture play a role, for example, in Charlottesville? Like, I think all of these things are really important. I think it's work that is kind of like the thing that we continue to need to do.
Shanti, it's interesting you bring up with the Victoria's Secret fake ad campaign how it was in part very successful because people weren't choosing to opt into it. It was like a viral thing that they saw regardless, so they might not be seeking this kind of information out. I'm curious who your, I mean, it sounds weird to say like target audience because it's not like a corporation or something, but who do you intend to reach with this kind of advocacy? And is it ever difficult, you know, to kind of advocate in this way when people don't want to deal with or think about or talk about difficult things?
Honestly, I mean, I feel like the different people involved in the organization, we all have like different personal priorities for who we want to reach.
Mm-hmm.
And that I don't know that we have, that Force has been like, this is our like target audience as much, except for like survivors. Mm-hmm. Because, and I think that, you know, maybe even works out well because like it allows us all to like pursue independent and like creative like thought about like how to target different groups of people who are personally important to us. So there's definitely that aspect.
I'm just sitting here like, good answer, good answer.
Oh, thank you.
Saida, you brought up the woman who was in her 60s, you said, mm-hmm. who had not realized that she was a survivor. And mm-hmm. I wonder what kind of generational differences have you guys seen when doing the monument quilt and when doing this advocacy work?
You know, I don't know if that's like something I feel like I'm qualified to speak to. I will say that I feel that across generations, I feel like that's something that I've witnessed across generations. Like, there will be people at any age who will come up and say, I didn't realize I was a survivor until I saw this. Now, they may say it in different ways or have different language around it. I think for me, it feels much more intense when I have an elder say it to me, because we tend to have this assumption, like when an elder says, like an elder, you know, will maybe know themselves in a different way. And I think that's like maybe what feels a little bit more shocking about it to me. But I will, I think it's a protective factor, you know. I think we will do whatever it is we need to do to survive. And I think what feels a little bit shocking about it when an elder says it is that I don't think we always recognize the fact that like that survival will kick in until like we're maybe 60 or 70 or 80 or even until we pass, you know. And I think that's maybe the hard part.
So a lot of my interaction is like my main job is to like have volunteers in the studio and help them like work on the monument quilt and creating it. So I think so most of the people who volunteer for, you know, are like college students. And there's like all different kinds of people who volunteer, but those are like the bigger groups I get in because their school has a service project or whatever, you know. So I would say like my like main thing is like I feel like the younger kids like know the like buzzwords or whatever, and like older people do not, which is like I don't think it's necessarily positive to have been like reading a bunch of like articles about feminism since you were a kid, because that's what I did, and I feel like it didn't necessarily help me. You know, but I do think that's where a lot of younger people are coming from now, is just so much access to the internet, and with social justice just like coming up in popularity again right now.
Why don't you think that was helpful to you to, you know, read about feminism as a young person, and why that might be a mm-hmm. negative for these younger people?
Well, you know, I don't want to say it was like fully negative, because I think a lot of, for me, like especially when I was younger, like it really helped me deal with my body image issues. And that was like one of the ways it was like most helpful for me to be reading stuff online, you know, like that. But I don't know. I just feel like a lot of like feminism that I encountered when I was young was like encouraging young women to be sexual. And like that, and like I understand where that comes from, because women, yes, should have like choice over like what we want to do and like our bodies, and we don't need to be like non-sexual or whatever. But as a kid, that was like unhelpful for me, and like I think a lot of people, you know, and I just, you know, and I feel like I'm a survivor of like BDSM abuse, and like a lot of stuff I read online was like, oh, feminism is like pro BDSM, like that kind of stuff. And it's not about being, you know, I'm not about like placing a judgment on like other people's like choices and lives and stuff like that. Just like, I don't really think it's healthy to encourage young people to experiment with, I don't know, just more emotionally and physically like risky sexual stuff. It wasn't good for me, and it wasn't good for a lot of people I knew.
Do you think maybe like it's more about like, I think maybe it's more about like having articles that like encourage critical analysis and like support?
Yeah, and I just don't think that that is what is present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it definitely was not when I was a kid. And just like what, you know, and I feel like what is like come up and is like popular now in like rape, anti-rape organizing and like feminist organizing, weren't, a lot of that stuff like was unhelpful to me.
Yeah.
What has surprised you both the most about doing this work?
I think just how much like it continues to resonate for folks, you know? So when we did I did a series of actions called La Poems for Brescia. Brescia Meadows, I don't know if you're familiar with her. She is a young Black girl who defended herself against her abusive father in Ohio. She was 14 at the time. He was killed, and he was abusing her entire family. She reported it multiple times to the police, her school social workers, and the prosecutors in the case were trying to charge her as an adult. And that would have ended up with her with a life in prison. and a whole campaign sprung up around it called Free Brescia. And as a result, fortunately, she ended up being charged as a child. I'm saying fortunately when this whole case is insane. But she ended up being charged as a child. And Free Brescia was asking people to, like, write letters and, you know, letters of support to Brescia, and also to write letters to the prosecutor asking them to drop the charges. And so we did a thing called La Palme for Brescia. And there were six different cities that participated in the action, where we had different organizations and poets who took part in, like, organizing them in solidarity with us. And what I was kind of just shocked by is, like, anyone who I asked to do it was like, oh my God, yes, of course. Yeah, let me do it. And the fact that people were just immediately, like, on board and just said yes and wanted to do it and got snacks and got spaces and got sponsorships and gave up their own time, really just, I was incredibly grateful. And I think that's how Force has been able to be so incredibly successful thus far, is because people are invested. I mean, we have three full-time staff members. You know, the only way that we can do this work is because people are here and people believe in us and people are working and walking right alongside with us. And I think that's what's been so surprising to me, which, and also so beautiful, is how much this work resonates with other folks.
I guess, like, I mean, and this is, like, kind of arrogant, but I was, like, I was young when I started working there. Just, like, how much I've learned just by working, you know. And at this point, that doesn't surprise me anymore, and it's one of my favorite parts of the job is, like, Saida was saying, like, all the different, like, volunteers and people we work with, I, like, learn from, like, so many different kinds of people, and just, like, you know, the, like, grace that people, like, bring in their lives when they have been, you know, surviving in their own way, and, like, not, you know, and then they choose to share that with me, you know, by coming to the studio, and they share that with everyone, you know, just, like, the, you know, their own, like, energy and resilience that they, and, like, just their entire self, I guess, that they, that up until that point, they're, like, bringing to share in that way is really powerful.
What's next for Force?
We have a whole bunch of quilt displays. We're doing one at Fort Belvoir in next week.
The 14th?
Yeah, on the 14th. And we're also doing Hike for Healing, which is our major fundraiser. Which supports the Monument Quilt and Gather Together, which is our Baltimore-based survivor collective. And that takes place on October 21st. And so if folks are interested in that, they can go to our website.
Thank you both for sharing and for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. You can find Female Trouble everywhere you listen to podcasts, and it would help us out if you subscribed and gave us a rating. We're also at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble and on Twitter at FMLTrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back with a new interview next week.